And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're talking with Eldon Taylor, author of Self-Hypnosis and Subliminal Technology. We're going to talk about some techniques for you as well. How can you do this? How can you better and change your life? More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Eldon Taylor, with us. Eldon, subliminal and hypnosis, is it close to being one of the same?
No, I mean, the answer to that is, they're both designed to do the same thing, and that is to communicate with the unconscious directly. But it's two different modalities. But, you know, before the break, you'd asked me a question, and I was about to conclude that. It had a two-part answer, and that was, your question was about, you know, how we could use subliminal. And the first part is, we have to be clear of what the technology is, and that was the whole point of the story about LAPD, et cetera. One of the things that I do in this book is show you exactly how to make your own subliminal program. The technology that we have proven in multiple double-blind studies that is not about burying things, but about shadowing them. The second part, and that has to do with the affirmations. The second part we also include is, you know, what is it you tell your unconscious mind when you decide you're going to employ either of these technologies, hypnosis or subliminal? I mean, look, when I went to hypnosis school the very first time, Harry Ahrens was the mentor, and he talked about a process called subconscious cerebration. I'll never forget this because of all the schools, and I think I've attended just about all of them, of all the schools that teach hypnosis, this notion of subconscious cerebration stuck with me, this idea. And I've seen it over and over again. It's the way the mind will take a sentence and tumble it like it's dice in a tumbler, okay? Like the lotteries that we see on television, okay, when the numbers are all being tumbled. So let's assume that what you're attempting to do is create either a post-hypnotic suggestion or an affirmation for your subliminal program that is designed to reduce cigarette smoking. And so what you're going to do, let's say you're smoking two packs a day, you want to cut to one pack, and so you're going to create this affirmation, and it says, I find 20 cigarettes a day more than enough for me. Now, that sounds like it's a perfectly good affirmation, a perfectly good post-hypnotic suggestion. But the way the mind tumbles this around, what it can well end up to be, especially with something like smoking, where we have all kinds of unconscious, subconscious drives and motives behind why we smoke, it'll tumble it. And when you tumble it, it's likely to come back out, I find more than 20 cigarettes a day enough for me. So this process, this becomes an important part of what you're doing when you're using hypnosis or subliminal technology. Now, the thing with both of them, to come to your new question, you know, are they the same?
Are they the same?
They're designed to access the unconscious directly. And the reason for that is that that's where the decision processes really take place. I mean, everybody today wants to talk about the prefrontal cortex, you know, short-term memory and decision decisions. The problem is the prefrontal cortex only makes about 10% of our decisions. The nucleus accumbens, and that's something everybody will become more and more familiar with, you know, in the next 5 years, it'll be as well known as the prefrontal cortex, because this area is in the unconscious, and it makes about 90% of our decisions. Now, we have fMRI studies that show an fMRI technician will know what you're going to decide as much as 10 seconds before you make the decision. Before you know what you're going to decide, the technician watching your brain knows what you're going to do. This little nucleus accumbens is already announced to the technician what your choice will be. Now, that should stop you in place, especially when you think about all the information that most people have in the unconscious, all this No, don't. You know, one of the things that I can tell you for sure about hypnosis, George, is we have a visual memory. We have a memory that's almost akin to videotape.
Right. I believe that.
I have used hypnosis in forensic situations. I remember an armed robbery as a case in point where I was called by the police department. An armed robbery had just gone down. The story, we had a theater manager who had closed the theater about 1 o'clock in the morning, driven to his night deposit, to make a night deposit there at the bank. Just as he put down the window, a big gun was shoved in his face, and they took the money. Now, under hypnosis, the only thing he could tell us without hypnosis was this was a very big gun. Under hypnosis, he described the hand that held the gun. And it was clearly a hand of an auto mechanic or someone that worked a lot with grease, etc. He described the vehicle that he'd seen for just but a second in his rearview mirror when the dome light had come on and the perpetrator had jumped out. Now, because he had been a Hertz auto manager, he could tell us the make and the year of the automobile. He gave us a little bit of a description about the driver that was in the automobile. The long and the short of it is, because in hypnosis we could replay this tape, if you will, we'd recovered the money before daylight the next day. I remember a homicide case where a young man was charged with killing his mother in a very brutal way. He pled to it. He had been told by the police department, the local police department, that if he pled, it was a first-time offense. He likely wouldn't get any prison. Well, that was all BS. He pled to it. He was sentenced to prison. His attorneys got a hold of me. They'd run a lie detection test on him, but it was a two-needle detection test. It was a illegal test by an unlicensed examiner. They had used this to bully this kid into confession. Now, this was not a clean one owner. This kid had drug involvements and petty involvements, juvenile record. But, you know, he was 18, maybe he was 19 years old at the time. And on that given night, he had been to a party, and he had imbibed. And so, I mean, he'd had some drugs, and he'd had some alcohol, and he couldn't remember anything except that when he got home, he found his mother bludgeoned, draped over her bed, and he sat down on the front porch trying to clear his head for a minute. Then he went back in and called the police department, and then, of course, the rest of the story you can pick up from there. But he couldn't remember what had happened. So because of this poly test and the buffaloing that had gone on, he pled to this case. Now, I ran a lie detection test on him, and he passed the test. But, you know, that only means that he didn't remember. He committed the crime. So then we did some forensic hypnosis, and under hypnosis, he was able to reconstruct that evening, remember this information that otherwise had been washed away because of drugs and alcohol. Uh-huh. And he was able to tell us that he had walked through the park on his way home. And on the way home, two police officers had pulled into the park. So he'd hidden under this bench while they searched the trash cans in the area. They then got back in their squad car, drove away. He then went home. Well, guess what? That gave us a hard timeline. And that timeline turned out to eliminate him from the possibility of being the one who had killed his mother. Okay? So he was in prison, and because of this testimony, he was released from prison, and, of course, the conviction was set aside. That's what I mean by the power that we have when we can really access the unconscious, the subconscious. We can get this entire videotape. So, you know, my fear of public speaking, my dental anxiety, the stuff that people deal with, we can find the causes to that, and then we can remedy them. And of course, what I wanted to do with this book was teach people how they themselves can induce hypnosis, manage it in the safety and the privacy of their own home to uncover and or to create programs that are designed to assist them, facilitate them, and whatever their goals or objectives are.
I'm convinced that the mind, Eldon, is like a tape recorder. And if you look at a crowd, let's say of 50 people, you may not be able to recollect all those 50 people and describe what they look like. But I bet under hypnosis, there's some way that the mind has recorded every person that your eyes saw.
You know, and I'm not going to disagree with that. We have cases where we have subjects that are light trance subjects, if you will. By that, I mean they're not a deep hypnotic subject. There are stages to hypnosis, and, you know, some without conditioning, some people will be lighter subjects than other subjects. Lighter subjects can do lots of great things. They can manage stress, teach themselves relaxation cues, you know, enhance their memory, their studying abilities. They can do all kinds of wonderful things. But the deeper subjects, the information, the experience I've had suggests that you're right. You get one of those subjects, and despite the fact that they have not consciously registered the information's there. You know, Poetzel did some really interesting subliminal work back at the turn of the century where he looked at, if I give you a subliminal image, would you vent this image in your dreams, especially if this image were provocative in its nature? It perhaps had an arousal factor to it. An arousal could be fear or anger, not just, you know, sexual in its nature. What he found was, of course, we do vent that information. So even though we're not consciously aware that we're processing information, that doesn't, you know, exclude the fact that we are nevertheless processing it at some level. And so you're absolutely right. I think if you walked into a room and there were 50 people there and you saw those 50, because I don't think you're going to recall what you don't see, you saw those 50, well, then you're probably going to be able to identify, recall them in some fashion or another if given enough time to make a deep enough subject out of you.
You know, it's like a satellite picture of a certain region or area, that if you call up the right kinds of logistics and the coordinates, you're going to see whatever that satellite saw at that moment. I think the eyes and the brain are the same thing.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I totally concur.
With self-hypnosis and subliminal technology, for yourself, if you were going to better yourself, which of the two would you use, or both of them?
You know, I'd use them both. And the reason I'd use them both is because of the convenience. One of the things that happens with hypnosis, you know, there's a lot of emphasis, for example, on meditation today. If you see your cardiac care specialist and your blood pressure is high, or you're a cardiac at-risk kind of patient, cholesterol counts or something, they'll encourage you to meditate. You know, just a little aside story, some 30-odd years ago, a friend of mine, a chief of police in Salt Lake City, called my home. And the housekeeper answered, and he was calling to let me know, you know, it's time to, we met every day for coffee. Time to meet for coffee, and she said, well, I can't disturb him. He's meditating. I'm going to tell you, George, 35 years ago, you could not believe the flack I took over the fact that I was meditating. But, you know, I was attempting to learn these things then, and so I was beginning, you know, meditation practices, using self-hypnosis to train myself to do that. Now, today, you know, full front square, that is mainline practice, and many hospitals teach it, and as I say, most healthcare, you know, people also suggest it. meditation is one of those states where, as with self-hypnosis, which I think is a great way to learn meditation, I think it's a better way than the way you typically learn meditation, requires that I'm going to assume a supine position of some kind. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to take 20 to 45 minutes out of my day, and I'm going to direct an experience. Maybe I'm going to direct a progressive relaxation, and I'm going to deepen that relaxation, and then I'm going to do my programming, whatever that is. Now, that's good. But in our pace of life, it can be really difficult to get that, you know, half hour, 40 minutes every single day out to do it. What you can do with a subliminal, on the other hand, is it offers a convenience. I can record this. I can create my own custom subliminal. I can play it in the background while I'm watching television. I can play it in the automobile when I'm driving, assuming it's not a sleep soundly program. So it's something in my office. I have those programs playing almost all the time. I don't if I'm doing a radio show or something where it becomes, you know, an outside sound. But if I'm just in my office and I'm working, my staff comes in, you know, or whatnot, even in meetings, I've got one going in the background. You can create them where you're putting to nature sounds like ocean or a babbling brook, or you can create them because maybe driving in your car, the sound of ocean is like having your windows down, where you put them to your favorite music. And you know, and that's all included in this new book. In fact, forgive the plug, but the bottom line is we used to teach this course of hypnosis and sell it for a couple of $100s. But, you know, because of the power that Hay House has in their distribution, we were able to put it together. People can get this book right now at Amazon for, I think it's $12. And it comes with a CD that teaches you this, and it comes with a number of URLs that further augment the training, both the subliminal and the hypnosis in both audio and video. So this is, to me, these are the two most powerful tools that an individual can have. And once you have them, you know, you're not spending thousands of dollars to make the changes in your life that you want. It's like owning your own mechanics tools or your own carpentry tools. They're easy to do, and they really save you a lot of money.
Well, they sure do. And Eldon, I want to talk about techniques when we come back, and then we'll take final phone calls with you next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. You've done this all your life, I assume.
You know, it feels like that. But, you know, the answer is I became very involved in the subliminal end of this as a result of the story I told you earlier, lie detection examination. The hypnosis side of it I became involved in much earlier because of my interest in why we do what we do. And then if you were to say, you know, well, how long have you been interested in why people do what they do? I'd have to say my entire life, you know. I think I was designed to be a lie detection examiner because when I was very young, I had a neighbor lady tell my mother a story about her and her husband breaking up. And for some reason, at the time, I knew she was making it up. Now, in 2020 hindsight, it's all about the body language, the eye movement, et cetera. Maybe I brought that into this lifetime, you know, pre-knowledge, I don't know. But at a very young age, I was maybe 8, 9 years of age, I blurted out, "You're not telling my mother the truth." Well, I got in a lot of trouble over that. But it didn't surprise me in 2020 hindsight that years later I'd be running lie detection tests.
We're going to take a few techniques from you, Eldon, when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you can sound off on Wednesdays. A Coast to Coast listener gets a chance to sound off. How can you send your sound off about a minute long with your phone number to editorial@coasttocoastam.com? That's our email address for this. editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Our producers will read it And if they like it, they'll give you a call and you'll record it and then play you back on a Wednesday here. So editorial at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Eldon Taylor as we talk about self-hypnosis and subliminal technology. And when I come back, let's talk a little bit about some tips on just how you can get into these altered states on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon, we'll get into some tips in a second and phone calls next hour. Are there some limitations on the ability of subliminal or self-hypnosis?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course there would be. I mean, I often get letters from people that want to do things that are, you know, out of the ordinary and inappropriate. But there are also those people that, you know, I want to be a millionaire. Can I win the lottery if I create a subliminal program to win the lottery? You know, the fact of the matter is what you're dealing with is still a very real world. You might increase your luck some, but, you know, stretching it that way is ridiculous. One of the things that I get concerned about is when people want to control other people. So I'll often have people request, can you create a program so that my girlfriend will love me more, or so she'll be more exciting in bed, or, you know, those kinds of things. So there are two real limitations that I look at. You know, the first one has to do with just expectation of what is realistic. Realistically, you're not going to be able to subliminally treat yourself to jumping off a building and flying. You're not going to become lighter than air because you have suggested to yourself you're going to become lighter than air. And the same with hypnosis. The second concern, however, is one of what you do with this technology and the informed consent or the karmic consequences that are involved if it's abused or misused. So the answer to your question, the long and the short, is there are very definite limitations to what you can achieve. Now, at the same time I say that, we understand today that the power of belief is much far beyond the pale of what we would have thought was normal or ordinary 30 or 35 years ago. We used to think, as I mentioned in the first hour, that DNA was hardwired. Well, we see that it responds to belief. We have multiple personality disordered patients who in one personality their eyes are blue and in the next personality their eyes are brown. Snap your fingers, personality change, eye color change, or perhaps a tumor on an arm that disappears with a personality change, blood sugar changes. And the only thing that's really happened here is the person has changed their belief about who they are. You know, I'm no longer Susie, I'm Sally, Sally is fun, Susie is a stick in the mud. It's a change in the belief about who that individual is. We have seen some incredible things just in my lifetime. I can remember, in fact, I think we discussed this, you and I once before, Roger Bannister breaking the four-minute mile.
I remember that.
And you know, to me, the real powerful thing about that is, well, you know, the physicians, the scientists, they all said it couldn't be done. That was the first part. But once that four-minute mile barrier was broken by Bannister, within the next 3 years, it was broken several times by many other runners. It had never been broken. And it, purportedly, the Greeks had chased runners with, you know, wild animals to try and get them to run it fast. It had never been broken. But once it was broken, something in the belief, the expectation of the public at large changed. It was no longer, you know, something that could not be done. So there are limitations, but there is also a great vista of possibilities. And I think of those possibilities when people ask me to define them, according to a question that was once asked of me, how high is up? I have no idea. We have savants on this planet who, as quick as a even faster than our fastest computers can calculate crime numbers. Or give them the day that you were born, you know, January 27th in the year, and they'll tell you the day it happened. Or they can read a phone book and then recite everything in that phone book. I mean, as fast as they turn the pages, they're memorizing it. And then you can say, well, who's on page 76? And they'll read everybody that is on page 76. We have incredible potential that we don't yet know how to unlock or manifest uniformly, but we have evidence that it is totally possible in this savant population.
Let's get a little bit into the guidelines and what people can do to pop themselves into this. And a lot of people talk about meditation, Eldon. You have too. How important is that?
Well, I think from a standpoint of your health, it's very important. I'd say critically important. But I cannot think of anything that you could do that would immunize you better than a regular meditation practice, and the data is sharing that with us. We're finding that more and more studies indicate the power of meditation, not just also from a health standpoint, but you know, we're seeing that meditating, for example, I read a study here just this last week that showed that compassion meditation boosted the neural basis of empathy. It literally affects the brain, and affects it in a way that, for all intent and purposes, increases our ability to learn, changes our attitudes and our moods. It's a form of self-reflection, but it immunizes us from a health perspective as well. I see a daily meditation practice is probably the best thing that you can do for your health. Maintain a decent blood pressure, desensitize stress environments, and we live in a 24/7 kind of world now. So it is, we accumulate stress and become less and less aware of it because there's more and more of it. So it's as though we're operating, all of us, at a higher stress level, but unaware that it's a higher stress level because the peaks are much higher and our standard has incrementally increased. Reducing that, taking that out of the system has so many beneficial health effects that it's incredible. The body basically has two budgets analogous to a government, George. One is defense. So, you know, you throw it into defense, say that person that cuts you off in 5 o'clock traffic and you're on your horn and you brake and you're all upset at, you do that kind of response and you do this little thing like shut down the optimal operation of your immune, your endocrine, and your autonomic nervous system. The other budget is growth. Keep yourself in that place of balance where, you know, like the duck out in the rain, you're rather impervious to the stress events that occur in your life. You see them in a context for what they are, what you need to do, you're able to do, but on the other hand, you're not reacting to them. You kind of change your definitions. The guy that cuts you off in 5 o'clock traffic, you don't slam your brakes. Instead, maybe you think, well, maybe he needs to hurry ahead. I mean, maybe there's a child that he's in the back seat of his car that's bleeding. He's taken to the hospital.
You don't know that.
But you change the perspective that you have toward these things, something that you can do in meditation and self-hypnosis. And as you do this, like I say, you literally immunize yourself. You maintain the body in this optimal state of growth, where those three main systems all function at their highest best. And so in answer to your question, I think meditation or the use of self-hypnosis, and in a way they're the same, they produce the same kind of brainwave state, they differ in so far as what is my objective. The serious meditators will seek contact meditation, if you will, that ineffable experience, one with a one. where, you know, self-hypnosis is maybe going to be used in a more practical sense for daily things and or for lighter levels of meditation. Not that you can't use hypnosis to get to that deeper set of meditation. You can, but it typically is the difference between what's my objective, what is it I'm trying to get done.
Where do magnets fit into some of this with hypnosis?
Well, you know, they really don't. But by reputation, they do, because Franz Anton Mesmer is basically the man that brought hypnosis into the forefront. And he used magnets and the bathing ponds together with hypnosis to bring about some rather remarkable cures. Now, in time, Mesmer, he ended up dying in disrepute.
Is that where we get the word mesmerize?
That's exactly where it comes from, George. That's exactly. James Braid came along and recoined mesmerism to hypnotism, and then later Braid wanted to change that, but by the time he wanted to change it, it stuck. But, you know, the term separates itself from the mesmerism because of the absence of the magnet. Now, with that said, today we see a lot of research that has showed a magnetic fields when applied to the brain can alter people's sense of various things, including their moral judgments. You know, there have been researchers that have, like Persinger, that have used magnetic fields to bring about supposed deep religious experiences. So there may have been much more to what Mesmer did with his magnets at the same time while he used hypnosis than what for a long time we believed was the case when hypnosis got totally separated from the magnets and the magnets basically fell into disrepute.
Well, how about that? All right, you have testified on hypnosis, and you've talked about some of the things you've done in the court systems. Does it hold up all the time?
What holds up with hypnosis is what you get out of it. Hypnotic testimony, let's take this homicide case that I explained to you earlier. The fact that this incarcerated individual, convicted of the homicide of his mother, underwent hypnosis and a lie detection test and passed the lie detection test, is insufficient for him to be discharged. What led to his release and the reversal of his conviction was the information gained in hypnosis. When he was able to describe law enforcement searching trash cans in a park, and we were then able to determine how long they were there and at what time in that night they were there, which is all part of, you know, the logs, we were able to show that he couldn't have committed the murder. Eventually, we actually did get the right guy, by the way, in that particular instance. What we have with hypnotic, let me digress also a little bit. As a forensic hypnotist, you must proceed with extra caution when it comes to using hypnosis. Let's say that we were to take a witness to an armed robbery in some convenience store. To say to this witness, what did he look like, would immediately dismiss that testimony as being prejudicial. And the reason is you are suggesting that it was a he. Maybe it was a she. So how you ask the question is very important. And then let's say that we got a pretty good description. And we got it the right way, without asking the leading questions, I would have a description. The description alone would be insufficient evidence. It would be a lead. it could take me to the perpetrator, but then I would have to tie the perpetrator to the crime in an evidentiary way without the testimony of this individual as a witness as a result of the revivified information in hypnosis. On the other hand, hypnosis can work to protect people. I had an instance once where I was called in by law enforcement because a woman, a young woman, had insisted that she had been attacked and raped in her home by a very influential person in the community. Law enforcement was somewhat reluctant. Well, they were just plain reluctant to act on her testimony. So they called in a psychologist, a hypnotist from the Utah State Prison, and he hypnotized the subject and came back and said, this is her testimony. This is what happened. Now, this was a psychologist trained as a psychologist who knew hypnosis. Nothing wrong with that. But when you're doing forensic work, it's a good idea to be a little bit of an investigator. Because the city PD wasn't comfortable with that, they called me in. And when I hypnotized this woman, it was clear that she was faking it. Wow. And when I gave her some ideomotor suggestions, that verified that she was faking. So that's okay. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take advantage of this situation. People, by the way, can lie under hypnosis. I'm going to take advantage of this situation, and I'm going to get the whole story in a relaxed way. I can just kind of ask her any question I want. This is like a super relaxed interrogation. So the story begins to unfold from the woman, and she explains how the perpetrator took his knife and cut her screen open and then raised her window because it was a hot night and she had the screens locked, but
she had it all down,
ajar. Yeah. And then he climbed through, and she described in great deal how he went to the kitchen and the drawer that he got the knife out of and how he held this knife to her throat and how he abused her and was just about to rape her, penetrate, when he heard something, some noise, he discarded the knife, and he ran out. Well, now, you see, I asked her, what kind of gloves did he have on? And, of course, as soon as I did that, she said, I don't remember, but he must have had gloves. And then I said to her, he took his knife and he cut open the screen. Why did he get a knife out of the kitchen? And her eyes popped open. And I said, so what is it that you've got against this man? Why is it that you... And she broke into tears, and she proceeded to tell me and everyone, because law enforcement was behind one-way glass. They were watching it, taping it, filming it all, what this fellow had done to her. Okay? Jesus. And it basically was they'd gone to school together, and then when he came back to the community, he'd become very important, but he ignored her, didn't even say hello to her.
She couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
That's what Elton, we're coming back. We're going to take some phone calls with you. Elton John on Coast to Coast AM.